is commanded.
Please be seated. Going to call 078P-1281D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael Hoopy. Justice Gableman will not be participating. We are going to first hear from Jeremy Levinson, counsel for the respondent.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jeremy Levinson. Along with my colleague Joseph Peltz, we represent attorney Michael Hoopy, the respondent in this OLR case. I would also point out that Mr. Hoopy's partner, Jason Abraham, is in attendance today.
Counsel, I would suggest you move the podium up and so you get closer to, I think it's on your left side.
Mm-hmm. Other side.
On your left side. Your other right-hand side.
What am I looking for?
There's a button, so the whole thing can go up.
Our shoulder for you.
Thank you. Is that better, Your Honor?
We'll see.
Attorney Hoopy has practiced in Wisconsin for almost 38 years, and he has never been subject to discipline. It is undisputed that he has been a vocal commentator and critic regarding the legal profession, its regulation, and lawyer advertising for many decades. For decades, this commentary, these criticisms, have been a part not only of his personal activities, but have been made given a substantial role in his firm's outreach to potential clients, in his firm's publications and mailings to potential clients. The overarching message has consistently been to urge the public not to rely on lawyer advertisements alone in selecting counsel. In particular, this commentary has also provided examples and discussions about how lawyer advertising, even that complies with the applicable rules, can be counterproductive to an informed decision on selection of counsel. Now, all that characterized Mr. Hoopy's activities for decades. Then, in June 2002, prominent Milwaukee personal injury attorney Charles Houseman was convicted of defrauding approximately 200 of his firm's clients. OLR was notified of this conviction. Mr. Houseman retained an active law license until August 30, 2005. Over three years. He was not subject to a summary suspension provided for by Rule 22.20, and despite the conviction, period of imprisonment, he retained an active license throughout that period of time, and his firm, and this is, I think, one of the key points, and his firm throughout that time itself aggressively marketed through mailed communications. And the hallmark of Mr. Houseman's firm's communications was the concept of trust and trustworthiness and the importance of lawyers you can trust.
How can I trust your statement that he was practicing law during the period of discipline when he came back into practice, the referee made a specific finding that he had not practiced law during the period of discipline?
Well, I think, and I, what is important to at least my argument regarding whether Mr. Houseman, whether it was a fair debate about whether he was practicing, is it is not necessary to find, as Mr. Essenberg was concerned with, whether Mr. Hausman violated the conditions of his suspension by practicing law. One of the independent arguments, and you're referring, Your Honor, to count two of the complaint here, one of our arguments was that Mr. Hausman bore the indicia of practicing law at least to the point where it was a matter of fair opinion and comment. And we, you know, as this court knows from its recent sort of ongoing rules-making exercise regarding a definition of the practice of law, there are numerous definitions, some more or less formal, more or less colloquial. It is not a clear, crisp, factual determination. We based our argument on one of the definitions provided by Section 757.30 that fairly read says anyone who is held out as authorized to practice law directly, indirectly, in writing or otherwise, so on and so forth, shall be deemed to be practicing law. And as our brief makes clear, there were several facts in existence at the time of the conduct alleged in count two that were consistent only with that definition of the practice of law. The easiest one, of course, is had I received Mr. Hupe's newsletter as part of the packet of materials his firm has mailed out, and I seized upon this verb tense in a three-word sentence fragment in the middle of an article that is one of several articles in a newsletter, and it struck me with sufficient force that I wanted to determine whether, in fact, Attorney Hausman was practicing. I could go to the Department of Financial Institutions and review, or order it online, review the annual report for the law firm, Mr. Hausman's law firm, which in March 2006 identified Mr. Hausman as a shareholder, correctly identified him as a shareholder, and that document would have certified that he was authorized to practice law. Now, whether it was oversight, whether it wasn't oversight, is not my concern. But that was, in fact, those were the facts on the ground when, according to Oler, this verb tense that had been correct in every technical and grammatical sense when written had become obsolete as a result of Mr. Hausman's suspension.
Well, they're asserting that it's not obsolete, but rather that it was a misrepresentation.
Well, Oler does agree that it had been true, the text that had been true, was something less than true. They use the word misrepresentation as a result of the changes in extrinsic events.
What's the difference between less than true and misrepresentation?
And there goes the bulk of my time.
That's right. You know what? In the interest of economy, I'll withdraw that question. I'm serious. I think it's a difficult question to answer.
And let me try and give a very brief and straightforward answer. If we extract that sentence from the article and write it on a chalkboard in the classroom, is it technically and grammatically incorrect if in the outside world Mr. Hausman was no longer practicing and had lost his appeal? Yes, of course. Now, the governing law, be it the rules, the comments to the rules, the interpretive case law, or the consistent guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court on these matters and this court, that is not the lens we bring to the question of truth or falsity in these cases, especially in cases involving government action, in particular government punishment of expression. And there we have the concepts of substantial truth. We have the common law before the constitutional law required that the common law overlooked minor inaccuracies. And the case law consistently holds that collateral or minor or lesser inaccuracies in a communication are not actionable, shall not be deemed to infect the entire communication with untruthfulness, unless they render the gist, the thrust, the point of the larger communication untrue. And taking count two, is practicing versus was practicing, the point of that article remained entirely unchanged, which is Mr. Huppie's discussion of how a lawyer convicted of defrauding 200 of his firm's clients was allowed to practice law or allowed to maintain an active license for a number of years, even when post-conviction. That point remained unchanged. Now, and I just to round out the discussion of count two, we have to take a step back and realize that that newsletter doesn't even identify Mr. Houseman or his firm. One would need information from another source to link them up. But on it, nowhere in that newsletter, nowhere in that article, does it identify the firm or the lawyer that was the inspiration for that example in the article. But backing up, because I think there's a simpler way to come at this case. I think the case raises a lot of issues, but it doesn't need to. This case can and should be resolved with a basic application of the rules and their interpretive case law and so forth to the evidence that was adduced. Now,
what do you expect this court to do? You've got three counts here, right? One was just three counts, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the recommendation is impose a public reprimand and costs, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. What do you want this court to do?
I would ask this court to dismiss the complaint against Attorney Huppie.
All three counts?
All three counts.
Well, why don't you take one count at a time and tell us why?
Certainly. As noted in the brief, I know that in these cases the standard of review is typically clearly erroneous on the facts, de novo on the law. As explained in our brief, what the United States Supreme Court commands is that given that this case seeks to punish expression, the court actually must conduct an independent de novo review of those facts that are said to bring Mr. Huppie's speech outside of the First Amendment. Now, on to the counts. The allegation is that the sentence that everyone agrees to be true, and the sentence is, lawyers can mail letters and advertise on television without ever having tried a personal injury case. That sentence, the placement of that sentence on the postcard, gave recipients a false impression. That's a quote of Oler's allegation, gave recipients a false impression. Well, there was zero evidence of any recipient's impression, whether they received an impression, if so, what it was, if they received an impression, whether it had any significance, materiality, or substance to it. Because despite Oler's allegation, and despite, frankly, the ease with which such evidence could have been proffered, there was no attempt to introduce such evidence.
Counselor, is it true that the law firm at which the comment was aimed had lawyers, all of whom who had actually tried a case?
Well, yes, is the answer to the question.
Just so nobody bothered to point that out, and there are many law firms where there are lawyers who don't try cases.
Right, and Mr. Huppie and his partner both forthrightly testified that one of the reasons they would never have intended that impression or allowed it to be communicated if they perceived it was they knew that there was trial experience at that firm.
Well, trial experience at the firm, in my view, is different from every lawyer in the firm having trial experience.
I agree, Your Honor. And one of the many sub problems in this case is the ambiguity of what the impression is contended to be. At various times, it's been that false impression about Mr. Houseman, false impression about the firm, false impression about all of the lawyers, some of the lawyers. The allegation in Oler's complaint is ambiguous. The testimony from Mr. Houseman and his partner, Mr. McNally, was inconsistent on this point. They've got different impressions. Some witnesses testified they got no impressions. Some witnesses testified they got different impressions. That has always troubled me about the count, because in moving to this world where an allegation of fraud can rest on sort of a non-demonstrable, or at least an undemonstrated, an unevidenced impression that we hypothesize recipients may have derived.
In a defamation case, do you...
What
do you do in a defamation case? Do you have to have evidence about what people on the street think? Do you have to have survey evidence?
I don't know that it needs to be survey evidence, but I believe that there needs to be evidence that, ultimately the trier of fact needs evidence to determine that there was harm to reputation. Yes. Whether it's survey evidence, whether it's that some of these recipients, and ironically, Mr. McNally in his testimony claimed that a handful of named clients of his had received the postcards and called the firm. And he testified they were upset, wanted to know more about it. I asked him, were they upset about the part of the postcard about defrauding 200 of your firm's clients, or were they upset about something else in the postcard? And he didn't have a recollection either way. But there were names of recipients, and there was just simply no evidence introduced about any impression by anybody. And what the case, if the cases say anything, I mean, in any case, setting aside the subject matter of this case, evidence is supposed to be the key ingredient. Lawyers aren't supposed to just simply, you know, we have an instruction. We tell juries lawyers' arguments are not evidence. And we have that for a reason. And the case is also for very good reason. And these are lawyer discipline cases. Governmental speculation, governmental hypotheses simply can't substitute for evidence.
Mr. Levinson, I've got a little different question. I listened to your comments a few minutes ago when you were talking about First Amendment rights and free expression. And as I look at counts 1 and 2, the postcard and the brochure, is there any doubt that this is a commercial speech?
I think, I don't think there's any doubt. I think it is plainly political speech, but I gather that's not going to satisfy the court. I think there are arguments.
Does it indicate on these mailings that these are advertisements?
I believe it does.
Doesn't that lead you to a conclusion that this is commercial speech?
For the purposes of the First Amendment, no, it doesn't. For the purposes of the First Amendment, the test under Wisconsin's case law and the U.S. Supreme Court's case law is whether the speech does no more than propose a financial transaction. Now, that is a phrase of art for First Amendment purposes, because it is designed to give a crisp definition so that the analysis doesn't wander into motives and dual motives. Now, can I forthrightly say that one of the main purposes of these writings was to reach out to prospective clients, create a favorable impression in the hopes of attracting those clients as clients of the firm? Of course. Having said all of that, under the commercial speech standards or the full First Amendment standards, I just don't think, and that's if this court wants to reach the constitutional questions at all, and it doesn't need to, I don't think that which set of standards applies matters all that much.
Do you have any question that commercial speech can be regulated more than normal free speech? That there are more restrictions on commercial speech?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. There are still limits, and there are still substantial burdens the government needs to carry in order to regulate or punish even commercial speech. I mean, I guess in light of the referee's hostility towards competition.
Okay, while you're talking about that, is that a motion? There was a motion here. It was a motion about the referee.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
What did you want to do, disqualify the referee?
Well, we asked him to recuse himself or to disqualify himself, yes, Your Honor.
He did not recuse himself.
That is correct. In a decision that he issued the same day as his report and recommendation, he declined to grant our motion.
And what did the court do with your motion?
I
think it held it in abeyance.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I know that we had asked this court to bifurcate the appeal and address.
That's right. And we said no.
That's correct. And we basically decided just to jump into the merits of the case at that point.
All right. Is that motion still before us?
I suppose it is, technically, yes.
Okay. I'm sorry to have interrupted
no,
you.
No, not at all.
It's one of my loose ends I wanted to tie up.
I understand. Thank you. Getting back to the postcard, this style postcard had been used by the firm for years as a regular piece of its regular mail program. It was not created for the purposes of Mr. Houseman. It even bore the challenged sentence. Used that sentence as a regular tagline for many years before the Houseman affair came into existence. And an example of that postcard can be found on the record. It's record site 139, which is the hearing exhibits, and it's exhibit 23 at page 3. The sentence that OLR wants to hang fraud on was a regular tagline repeatedly and consistently used by the firm for years. As an aside, it delivers helpful information to the public. And the postcard was also a standard piece of mail that went out for years. When the Houseman affair appeared, it was simply folded into a pre-existing mail program, which gets to the question of, I mean, gets to the question of the need to prove with clear and convincing evidence knowing falsity or reckless disregard. And again, these terms have clear definitions. Zero proof on either component. And in fact, all of the evidence on the point shows that neither Mr. Hupe nor anyone else at his firm even perceived the impression at issue. And if they did not actually perceive it, they could not have acted knowingly or with reckless disregard towards it. And the record is not only devoid of evidence against that proposition, but the record has consistent evidence supporting the proposition that the most fundamental ingredient to knowing falsity or reckless disregard was absent, which is that they knew they were giving that impression. And that would require actual knowledge. I would point out that OLR itself reviewed the postcard 2 times, found no problem with it. In fact, OLR investigator telephoned Mr. Abraham after the grievance came in, indicated, yes, we reviewed it when it was first submitted pursuant to rule. As we do when a grievance comes in, we've looked at it again. I've already spoken to Deputy Director. We're closing the grievance. Apparently, it was only on Oler's 3rd pass at the postcard did it discern this problematic impression. So to the extent there's some evidence on the matter, I suppose that's as good as any. Finally, on count 1, no evidence of materiality, no evidence that it matters to anybody. And what, in prepping for the hearing, what I contemplated was Ola bringing in a recipient to claim, I read this postcard and thought this sentence about trial experience referred to Houseman or the firm or so on and so forth. In my cross-examination, one of the questions was going to be, did it matter to you that Mr. Houseman and or his firm lacks trial experience? Because, and this is just a guess, we have no evidence, so I'm going to have to guess. I'm going to guess that the answer would have been, after hearing that the guy did prison time for defrauding 200 clients, I'm not all that concerned about the depth of trial experience. I don't know that to be true. It's certainly not the only possibility. But if we had tried this case like cases should be tried, I would have had a witness to ask the question of. Count 2, we all agree the text was accurate and true on every level, as literal as you want to go. When it was written in 2003, it was simply as it was used as part of the mail program regularly. There came a time when Mr. Houseman lost his criminal appeal. There came a time when this court suspended his license. No evidence that Mr. Hupe was aware in real time of those events. And the postcard and the article continued to be reprinted word for word, verbatim, without editing. The only evidence on the point shows that Mr. Hupe had no particular awareness of this potentially problematic verb tense in the phrase in the middle of that article. Once again, if he didn't have actual awareness of the problem, he couldn't have behaved recklessly or knowingly with regard to it.
Your client indicated that the article was reprinted, but he wasn't aware that the three-year-old article contained the specific challenge phrase. You know what I'm referring to?
Generally speaking, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The fact that you didn't read the article or review the article, do you view that as reckless disregard?
I view that. I think the standard you have just articulated is off-the-rack negligence at most. Because he should have. The contention is he should have reviewed it. Monthly, maybe? Annually?
Every 3 years?
I see my red light is on. Unless the court has any further questions, I will take my seat.
Okay, Mr. Levinson. Thank you. Julie Scott from the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Ms. Scott.
May it please the court, my name is Julie Scott, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the present disciplinary proceedings. I would like to first address the point that Justice Bradley brought up with regard to whether or not Mr. Hupe practiced law, or Mr. Hausman practiced law during the time of his suspension. Referee Winarski was the referee for both the disciplinary proceeding against Mr. Hausman, for his reinstatement proceeding, as well as for the disciplinary proceeding against Mr. Hupe. Referee Winarski was very familiar with the facts and found that Mr. Hausman did not practice law during his period of suspension. This is based on several factual, several elements of fact, strike that. This is based on several factual allegations that were brought out. First of all, Mr. Hausman spent 5.5 months during his suspension in Arizona attending classes and doing charitable work. There was no evidence that he performed any legal work during his suspension, or that he met with any clients during his suspension, or that he was even on the premises of the law firm during his suspension. It's important to note as well that attorney Schneidman, who originally represented Mr. Hupe, was present at the office at the time that Mr. Hausman's suspension went into effect, and he was making sure that they were complying with all the rules regarding Mr. Hausman's suspension from the practice of law. They also alleged that there was a website out there. However, the referee found that, as a matter of fact, Mr. Hausman and Mr. McNally were not aware of that website being out there. Once they became aware of that website, they did immediately discontinue the website. The practice of law does not include the fact that Mr. Hausman remained on the DFI, Department of Financial Institutions, statement for a portion of the time that he was suspended. That doesn't constitute the practice of law under Wisconsin law. Also, the fact that Mr. Hausman remained a shareholder in the Hausman McNally firm does not evidence Mr. Hausman actually practicing law during the period of suspension. It's very important to note that Mr. Hupe was not even aware at the time this flyer or this brochure went out that Mr. Hausman's name was on the DFI documents, or that he did remain a shareholder. As the referee found, Mr. Hupe did not learn of these factual allegations except for during the hearing in the Hupie disciplinary matter. He was not aware of this from August of 2005 through March of 2006 when the brochure was disseminated to the public.
Counselor, did this action arise as a result of a grievance by the Hausman Law Firm?
Mr. McNally filed a grievance with the Office of Labor Regulation, I think via his attorney, with regard to the postcard and the brochure.
Did the action against Mr. Hausman in any way commence due to any actions of Mr. Hupie's or his partner in his law firm?
Could you state?
Yeah, I understand that it was part of Mr. Hausman's law firm who generated the matter we're now hearing. They filed a grievance, and then you proceeded on it.
Correct.
My question is, earlier, did someone from Mr. Hupie's law firm commence the grievance against Mr. Hausman? Now, I know he was convicted, and that in and of itself may be a separate example, but was anything about his circumstances brought to OLR's attention by Mr. Hupie or a member of his firm?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Another just brief point that I would like to make that Justice Abramson brought up is I believe that the motion to bifurcate was denied by this court previously, and it's not an issue at this time. If we go to count one with regard...
I'm sorry, counsel. I have another, if you will, housekeeping matter, and that is the issue of costs. In your reply to the objection of costs, you indicate that OLR will be filing a supplemental bill of costs and so that it's premature to handle that issue now. You indicate in your response that consequently, detailed arguments concerning the proposed cost assessments are arguably premature. What I am concerned about is one of the objections noted by the respondent is that the referees' charges are way excessive, and they're way excessive compared to OLR's charges. They indicate that the referees' charges are 400 hours more, greater than five times the OLR's charges at present time.
Correct.
I'm caught in a bit of a quandary because when I looked at the hourly charges, it looks like that OLR hasn't documented all its charges. And that's not, as I sit here now, of great concern to me, but what is of great concern is if it hasn't documented all its charges, then to say 400 hours more isn't accurate, and how are we supposed to deal with that?
At this time, I have not reviewed what hours were documented on the OLR's objection or answer to the objection to costs. That is something that we can address once we file our supplemental costs.
Generally,
statement.
Supplementals are filed as of the date of the last filing of costs. And in this case, for instance, I think there were maybe about 6 or 7 days of trial, and only days January 13th, 2009, January 14th, 2009, and the final hearing day on February 27th are not in there. Also, it doesn't appear that there's any time for briefing or preparation in this case that really
involved lots of motions and discovery. That's detailed in the referee's reports. So what should be done about that?
Well, that might be a typographical error, and I think that the OLR should, we should probably go back and look at that and make sure that the cost statement is accurate on the OLR's behalf. If there aren't dates noted on there for trial, it may be typographical, and that can be.
And if nothing is noted for preparation of briefs or preparation for hearings, that could be added to if it's
yes.
true. You know.
Yes.
But right now, it just seems odd to me that there are motions and briefs filed according to the referee's report, but there's no billing for any of that. On OLR's part.
That the OLR should take a closer look at for the accuracies in the OLR's
When was the
of
hearing
costs.
In this case?
Pardon me?
When was the hearing in this case?
I can't remember the exact dates of the hearing.
They were January 12th, January 13th, January 14th, February 17th, February 18th, February 19th, and February 27th. I understand.
They show. He shows.
He shows
preparation.
Yeah, but OLR doesn't.
Yeah, the OLR will double check on that, and we'll make sure that their cost statement is accurate and that there aren't
any
types of
Scott, the court denied the bifurcation motion, but I don't know that. Are you telling me the court denied the motion to disqualify the referee?
No.
Okay.
The court denied the motion to bifurcate.
But it has not dealt with the motion that's still outstanding.
Well,
it was waived when they went to hearing?
Waived when they went to hearing. They did not bring it up in their briefs. It would be OLR's position that if this court granted or denied the motion for bifurcation, that that issue needed to be addressed by Mr. Hupe in his briefs to this court, and he did not. He chose to address the factual and legal issues in the case and not the issue of bifurcation.
Okay.
Going back to count one, we are talking about a single postcard that was placed in a packet of documents going to potential personal injury clients. We're talking about a single postcard that relates specifically to Chuck Hausman and the Hausman McNally firm. We are not talking about just a justification of the true statements that Mr. Hupe has used in the past, that lawyers can mail letters and advertise on television without having ever tried a personal injury case. Here we are talking about a purposeful intent of Mr. Hupe to place this language in a postcard specifically dealing with Mr. Hausman. There's no other reasonable interpretation when reading that postcard other than the fact that this postcard and all the language contained within that postcard refers to Mr. Hausman and the Hausman McNally firm.
Now, Scott, I've got a question about count one, and it relates to a case decided several years ago by this court. The case is the case of Elections Board versus Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. And when I read the information submitted here, the briefs of counsel, it brought back that case loud and clear. And I want to find out if the facts as I understand them are correct. I read that the postcard was submitted to OLR and approved by OLR for mailing. Is that indeed correct?
The postcard was submitted to OLR in this case. It was approved not for the context of the postcard itself. It was approved for basically the form of the advertisement.
Did OLR object to the postcard, say it was improper, shouldn't be sent out?
The OLR didn't object because it doesn't look at the postcard for its context.
What does it look at?
It looks at the postcard to make sure that it's complying with the advertising rules, that it specifically states on the postcard that this is an advertisement, and that it falls within the four corners of the rule. It does not look at the content of the postcard itself or conduct an investigation to determine whether or not the language contained within that postcard is true or false.
When OLR responds to a request to review a document such as the postcard, what goes back to the law firm? What is the law firm told? We reviewed it and we approve it, or what is specifically said?
I don't know what specifically is said. I don't believe that the OLR responds unless they find a problem with it, and the problems would be if the postcard didn't state this is an advertisement on it, and if it didn't fall within the four squares of the advertising rule. The OLR would never review the document unless there was just something so blatantly wrong with the language that there was a potential problem with the content of the postcard itself.
Is there any disclaimer given back to the law firm that submits a card such as this postcard saying we have not reviewed the content as far as whether or not it's appropriate? We've only looked to see if it satisfies the advertising rules?
I believe that it's just known. And it's a policy of the OLR that that's all that they look at when they review the postcards. They don't look at it for content or for the truth or falsity of the allegations contained within. They basically just make sure that it complies with the advertising rules itself. It doesn't look into whether or not any of the language is misleading to the public.
How is that conveyed to a submitting law firm?
I don't know if there is any response unless there's an issue with the advertisement. All attorneys are required to submit their advertisements to the OLR. The OLR does a just quick cursory review of the advertisement to make sure that it has the magic language on the advertisement and then places it in a file. Nothing else is done at that point in time.
So there must be a rule that covers this, of submission to the OLR.
Do you know what the number, what the rule
the
is?
The advertising number is SCR 20:7.2.
Correct. I'm going to that right now, and basically, the office looks at it just to make sure that it complies with the rule that the communication contains the name and office of at least
one. You reading
one
from?
I'm reading from 20:7.2, subsection 3, which says that any communication made to this rule shall include the name and office address of at least one lawyer or law firm responsible for its content.
Give me that site again, please. What are you reading from?
20:7.2c.
Ours don't show that. Does your statute show that?
No, but I'm familiar with what you're reading. I know what you're reading, that it has to have any advertisement that's sent out. Has to have that it is an advertisement, and it has to have the name of the lawyer or law firm responsible.
That's C.
Correct. That's C.
But I don't see where the OLR has to come in, comes into effect.
And then I mean, essentially I believe that the office looks at the advertisement just to make sure that it complies with 20:7.2, the advertising statute. Specifically as it relates to the office name and address of an attorney responsible for it, I also believe that there is a requirement that it does state advertisement on the document. If you look at 20:7.3, direct contact with prospective clients, subsection C refers to every written, recorded, or electronic communication from a lawyer. shall include the words advertising material on the outside of the envelope. And so the Office of Lawyer Regulation also looks at the advertisement to make sure that it does state that it is an advertising material. Those are essentially the two or three items that the OLR solely looks at when reviewing advertisements that come into its office. In terms of the content of the advertisement, the OLR would only look at the content if there was something blatantly wrong with the content or there was a grievance filed, as there was in this case. And when you look at this advertisement, just to note, John McNally did testify at the hearing that every single attorney at his law firm has tried a personal injury case. So that language, specifically as it relates to the Hubman McNally firm, is false.
Did it tie the lack of trial experience to that firm?
It's tied by the fact that you have a single postcard. The single postcard, the title on the postcard is "Beware, you will probably get a letter from a law firm whose senior partner went to prison on November 28, 2003. The content in the postcard specifically discusses the Hausman McNally Law Firm and Chuck Hausman with regard to his imprisonment for defrauding 200 clients. In that same paragraph, you have lawyers can mail letters and advertise on television without ever having tried a personal injury case. That's the full content of the postcard. There's nothing else contained in that postcard. Therefore, somebody reading this postcard would be no question that language was placed in there to refer to the Hausman McNally firm.
Well, it just says lawyers can advertise without ever having tried a case. It doesn't say the lawyers in any particular firm have done so. Correct?
But if you use general interpretation rules with regards to the language of contracts or the language of reviewing a document, when you get a postcard that is specifically referring to, and the title of the postcard specifically refers to the Hausman McNally firm and Chuck Hausman, you're going to interpret that postcard as referring to that firm and to Chuck Hausman. You can't just separate out lawyers can mail letters and advertise on television without ever having tried a personal injury case when you're only speaking about the subject matter of the Chuck Hausman firm. That language had been used previously by Hupe in other advertisements that he had sent out. However, the referee found there was a specific intent of Mr. Hupe in this case to take that language and to place it in a postcard specifically referring to the McNally Law Firm. There's no other interpretation but that language referred to Chuck Hausman, to the McNally Law Firm, and was not referring to any other law firms or attorneys.
Well, that certainly is the interpretation of the referee. My concern is whether it's the only reasonable.
I believe that there's no question, and the referee did find that the language was placed in the postcard deliberately, knowingly, and in reckless disregard to the truth, which he stated on page 9. It's the OLR's position that no hypothetical reader could interpret that language as referring to anything but the Hausman McNally Law Firm.
What's your answer to the argument that this seems to all violate freedom of expression?
Well, this isn't a case where the OLR is prosecuting Attorney Hupe for sending out advertisements concerning either Charles McNally or the McNally Law Firm. We wouldn't be before this court if the language that Mr. Hupe had in his postcard, in his brochure, on his letterhead were truthful statements.
Well, aren't you chilling speech by prosecuting him for speech?
We're not, the OLR is not chilling speech under the First Amendment, because if you go to the First Amendment, the referee found that this was in commercial speech. And even Mr. Hupe, in this argument, admits that the primary purpose of these, of all the postcards and advertisements that went out, were to attract clients. The OLR has a right to prosecute Attorney Hupe if his advertisement is deceptive or misleading under the law regarding
maybe
the First Amendment.
Maybe this code section is unconstitutional.
The law is clear. If you look at Zotterer versus the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, which is a United States Supreme Court case, they have held that commercial speech that is false, deceptive, or misleading can be governed by the state or by the disciplinary offices in the United States.
Are you familiar with 100.18, the Ag and Consumer Protection Code, which sets forth violations of false, misleading, and deceptive advertising?
I am not aware of that code. But it's clear with case law that the OLR can prosecute an attorney for misleading and deceptive advertisements, and that's what the OLR is doing in this case today.
Was this misleading, misrepresentation, false, or deceitful? Any of the above, all of the above?
The OLR is alleging in count one that stating that lawyers can prosecute cases or can advertise when they haven't prosecuted cases or tried a personal injury case is a misrepresentation when it refers to the Hupe firm. In count two, from August of 2005, Mr. Hausman's suspension through March of 2006, the OLR is alleging that it's a misrepresentation that Mr. Hupe stated that Mr. Hausman is still practicing law pending his appeal, because during that time, it's very clear on the record that Mr. Hausman was not practicing law. Mr. Hupe has a duty to ensure that the documents that are going out of his office, his advertisements, are truthful. And there was some testimony that he does review advertisements that go out of his office. If he did review this advertisement, he should have seen that the advertisement was false and it was misleading, in that Mr. Hausman was suspended and he wasn't practicing law. And at the time that that advertisement went out, I believe that Mr. Hausman had been out of jail for approximately 2 years, and he had already been convicted a while before that date. We're talking about multiple advertisements going out here as well. We're not just talking about a single advertisement that went out to a few clients. We're talking about advertisements such as in count one that went out to thousands of clients between December of 2003 and February of 2004.
Counselor, one of the
potential
things
clients
that you're concerned about is that when the statement about Mr. Hausman having been imprisoned for fraud, the first time around that it was sent out, it was true. The second time it was sent out, you're saying it was not true because of the verb tense, right?
That's correct.
Okay, but if I look at your other objection here, what it says is lawyers can mail letters and advertisements on television without ever having tried a personal injury case. It doesn't say they have. So you're overlooking this verb tense when you say, if it would have said lawyers have mail letters and advertisements on television without ever having tried a case, and that was focused on the Hausman Law Firm, then you would say that's untrue because, as you told me, they all had personal injury trial experience. But that isn't what the tense is. It says lawyers can, so they can do it in the future.
I think maybe your argument, at least it sounds inconsistent to me. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, because when you're looking at the language of this sentence contained within the paragraph that it's in, the only interpretation that a potential reader could get from reading this is that lawyers can mail letters and advertise on television without ever trying a personal injury case, okay, is that the Housman and McNally attorneys can advertise on television and mail letters to potential clients without ever having tried a personal injury case.
I understood your argument to be somewhat different. I understood your argument to be that this was an allegation that lawyers who had tried cases were being represented as though they had not by this phrase in the advertisement.
Well, see what I'm saying?
I mean, if the advertisement had said lawyers have mail letters and advertised on television when they've never tried a case, then I can see more your argument. But that isn't what the advertisement says. It says that lawyers who have never tried a case can do this. Well, if they hired a lawyer tomorrow that didn't try a case yesterday, I don't see how that's, even if you focus on that firm, I don't see it's how it's accusing them of past conduct that's inconsistent with the experience of the lawyer.
I would just respectfully disagree and say that if an ordinary person is reading this postcard in and of itself, that an ordinary person reading this would assume by that language that the attorneys at the Hausman McNally firm had never tried a personal injury case, yet they're advertising on TV and they're sending mailings out to potential clients.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions that this court has?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Scott. Mr. Levinson.
Justice Abrahamson. This case surely is about the values protected by the First Amendment and its Wisconsin counterpart. But well before it implicates those values, it is a case about basic fact-finding process and evidence. The allegation in count one against my client was recipients received the false impression that the lawyers at the firm did not have trial experience. There was no evidence of any recipient. There was no evidence of any impression. What has followed has been nothing more than lawyers asserting it is clear, you know, and concluding perfunctorily that it is misleading, which is, of course, exactly what the referee offers, nothing more than the declaration than it is what I say it is.
Well, suppose that after listening to today's argument, another lawyer tells the newspaper, quote, Attorney Jeremy Levinson arguing for Attorney Hupie will likely be mentioned in tomorrow's newspaper as arguing a case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Even tax cheats can argue cases before the court. Would you take offense?
Probably.
Yeah.
Would
Why?
I, because it's kind of a sleazy suggestion. Now, would I?
What does it suggest?
Oh, it tries to suggest I'm a tax cheat. It doesn't suggest it very well.
Accurately either.
Or accurately. Thank
well,
you.
Well, we're not trying you here. Okay.
I got your back. Don't worry.
The point is this. Would I expect the government to step in and impose punishment for that? Of course not.
You're going to file a complaint with the OLR?
No. Fun of the reporter, if you have to.
If you were not the reporter, it's the lawyer who said that about you.
I understand. I might call the lawyer and give him or her a hard time.
If it were an advertisement as opposed to news, would you respond differently? I have in the back of my mind, as I
mentioned earlier, under 100.18 and 100.20 of the Wisconsin statutes, the Attorney General can bring actions for false, misleading, and deceptive advertising. And if anyone is injured as a result of the false, misleading, and deceptive advertising, they also can act and initiate proceedings as a private Attorney General for any pecuniary losses that they've sustained. And so with that by way of background, I don't know why there's First Amendment stuff here.
Well,
unless those statutes are unconstitutional, but they've been used many, many, many times.
No, of course. And to respond to something Justice Abraham said before, we don't contend the rule is unconstitutional. We contend that if it is stretched in the way Oler seeks to stretch it, and if it is applied pursuant to the process that has been used here, it would raise constitutional questions.
What's the stretch?
The stretch is applying Rule 8.4 sub C to, let's take count one, to a postcard merely alleged to give a false impression.
So the stretch is false impression.
The stretch is, let me put it this way, and I will refer to this court's decision in Ray Beaver, in which it was looking at the offensive personality section, and the court saw the need to limit the scope of that section, and so it looked back on the offensive personality case. Why did that with 8.4 sub C? And throughout Wisconsin and frankly around the country, I was not surprised to find that they are limited to what is readily understood to be fraudulent and behavior that is dishonest in a universally understood way, and behavior that is capable of causing harm or injury of the type the rules seek to guard against. They are all of a kind, and this case is well outside of that scope.
That's the stretch.
Writ large, that is the stretch. Now, beyond that, getting back to the postcard, what we heard is an argument that, from beginning to end, is there is no other interpretation. The witnesses, the only witnesses who were not recipients, actually testified as to a range of impressions. Some witnesses found no impression. The postcard, which needs to be considered as a whole, starts with saying, here's one example of what lawyer advertising has come to. Then talks about the Hausman and McNally law firm naming only one individual. Then comes the sentence, lawyers can mail letters without ever having to, or advertise on TV without ever having tried a case. Then it goes on to say you'll be getting a letter with an article about how to find a good personal injury lawyer. This postcard is express in using the Hausman matter as one example of a larger criticism. And the fact is, I won't stand here and say no recipient could possibly have read it the way Oler does. But the fact is, there certainly will be recipients who correctly understood this, the sentence at issue, as a general statement about lawyers, and frankly, as a true statement. But my more fundamental point is, if we had evidence, we wouldn't have to be guessing. I see my red light is on. Could I ask the court's indulgence for 30 more seconds?
You do, and you have.
Thank you.
And
count you three, will. Your Honors. The only evidence on count three, every single witness who ever worked at the law firm testified that they had been told and had consistently been given the understanding the firm dated back at least until 1969. This includes, strike that. The undisputed evidence is that the firm's founding member, Thomas Jacobson, personally approved that as the firm's founding date when he agreed with Mr. Hupe to start this firm practice of using an anniversary sticker on certain advertisements in the 1990s. Every single witness with knowledge of A, the firm's actual founding date, and B, the firm's understanding, true and good faith understanding of its own founding date, testified that the date claimed here was accurate and understood to be accurate. Three Wisconsin business lawyers testified that the law of business continuity places it back at least as far as 1969. There is not one jot of contrary evidence in the record. What Oler argues...
Mr. Jacobson testified to the contrary.
I thought Mr. Jacobson testified to the contrary. Tom Jacobson, didn't he say that he didn't intend to transfer when he left the firm, to transfer any lineage of the firm?
What he testified to was, as to the precise moment Mr. Melnick joined him, as whether it was 69 or 70, he couldn't recall. He did, however, point out that if Mr. Hupe had better recollections, he had no doubt they were correct. What you're referring to, Your Honor, is this: the stock purchase agreement, as virtually all law firm stock purchase agreements state, is you can't use my name after I'm gone, because, of course, that has always been prohibited on an ethical basis anyway. Testimony is that was a pro forma clause. Through the referee's questioning, it was elaborated into a concept of Mr. Hupe didn't buy the hit Mr. Jacobson's history or some such thing. In conclusion, Your Honors, the easiest way to resolve this case is there is no evidence of any element. Even if there is some theoretical argument, because we have no evidence, all we can do is argue of inaccuracy. The only evidence on the mental state of Mr. Hupe is that he acted in good faith and without any recklessness or intentionality. In fact, he was incapable of it because he didn't perceive himself to be making the communications as alleged. Final, very liberal use of my 30 seconds. You asked Chief Justice whether the speech was being chilled here. This is one of those rare cases where I don't have to theorize to answer the question. The referee's report expressly states that's the whole point. And it's an extensive quote in our brief. If respondent is sanctioned in this case, it will be harder for him to, quote, exploit Houseman's conviction for competitive purposes. It was one of his explanations for why this man should be punished. Should be punished based on these snippets, these ambiguous, insignificant snippets. Why, in the referee's mind? To stop him from using true, important information about another lawyer in his public discussions about lawyering, lawyer regulation, and lawyer advertising. Thank you very much. I appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you, Attorney Levinson. Thank you, Attorney Scott. And this ends our hearing in 07AP1281D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael Hupe. The court will be in recess until tomorrow, when we'll hear our last set of, we'll hear some more oral arguments in January. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:15.